and next week we'll be finishing up the book of Exodus. I went ahead and you can't hear me. Is that for real? You can't hear me? I can turn my mic up. I'll give you all the mic I can. How about that? How's that? Or maybe I busted my chops. Well, you could be. I sound very murky today. Thank you. Oh, he was messing with me. Is that too loud for y'all? Well, I know I'm fine, but we're not talking about what I look like. We're talking about, you know, is the level okay? All right. Okay, good deal. Oh, brother, yeah, it's getting deep, Patty. I have a way of doing that. Okay. No, smote is past tense. Somebody smite him is what you want to say, Patty. Okay. We are going to be in Exodus chapter 39, verses 1 to 32, whole chapter. I think that originally we're only supposed to be to... we are, okay, all of them. Then 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 13 to 51. Then we're going to do Psalm 68, and then Hebrews 8, 1 to 5. Not very much in the Brit Hadashah today, although I have a... And it's really a short commentary as well. The whole commentary this week is only taking up 6 printed pages, so it will not be that extensive. So I hope that you all will be bringing some thoughts to the mic, so that we can all glean from everybody. Anyway, we're going to go ahead and get started, as we've been starting for the last 3 or 4 months, 5 months, however long it's been. We're going to start with the Shema, and it goes like this. Shema Yisrael, Yehovah Eloheinu, Yehovah Echad, Baruch Shem Kavod, Malchuto, Leolam Vayed. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah our Elohim, Yehovah is one. Blessed is he whose glorious kingdom is forever and ever. Amen ve'amen. That is the central truth of Scripture, and that's why we start with it every month, or every week, rather. We're going to be in Shemot 39 today, and let's open that with a short word of prayer. Father, thank you for bringing us all together here today so that we can study your word. We know that the more we study your word, the more we conform, and the more we apply your word to our lives, the more we conform ourselves to the image of your Son. And that is our goal. Because if we conform ourselves to the image of your Son, we will conform ourselves to your image. And that is the ultimate destiny of all of us who believe, to become one with our, not only our Messiah, but also with you, our Father. Now, Father, there are in each room, not just the Pal Talk rooms, but I'm talking about in each room in which someone is sitting and looking in and listening today, there are spirits of both the good kind and of the evil kind. We'd ask that your spirit, your Holy Ghost, your Ruach HaKodesh, will indwell in a special way every person in this room today, so that we can understand what truth comes out, so that we can make it a part of our knowledge, we can make ourselves conform to the truth. And also, Father, we ask that you would take the minds and understanding of those evil spirits that are in the rooms and just confuse them, make them absolutely unable to understand the truth that we teach today and that we learn from other people out there in Pal Talk land today, that they won't have some way to plan against the truth that's coming. We ask those things in Yeshua's name, and we thank you for the answer to those prayers in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right. As I said, we're in Shemot, or Exodus chapter 39, and we're going to go ahead and read that whole chapter. Now remember that last week we were talking about the Mishkan and how it was all put together, okay? And here we are again. And of the blue and purple and scarlet they made cloths of service to do service in the holy place, and made the holy garments for Aharon, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And listen for how many times Yehovah tells us that they did it exactly as Yehovah had commanded Moshe. That's the first one. And he made the ephod of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet, and fine twisted linen. And they did beat the gold into thin plates, and cut it into wires, to work it in the blue, and in the purple, and in the scarlet, and in the fine linen, with cunning work. They made shoulder pieces of it, to couple it together. By the two edges was it coupled together. And the curious girdle of his ephod that was upon it was of the same, according to the work thereof, of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twined linen, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And they wrought onyx stones, enclosed in ouches, or containers of gold, graven as signets are graven, with the names of the children of Israel. And he put them on the shoulders of the ephod, that they should be stones for memorial to the children of Israel, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And he made the breastplate of cunning work, like the work of the ephod, of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twined linen. It was four square. They made the breastplate double. A span was the length thereof, and a span the breadth thereof, being doubled. And they set in it four rows of stones. The first row was a sardius, a topaz, and a carbuncle. This was the first row. The second row, an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row, a ligure, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They were enclosed in ouches of gold in their enclosings. And the stones were according to the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engravings of a signet, every one with his name, according to the 12 tribes. And they made upon the breastplate chains at the ends, of wreathen work of gold, of pure gold. And they made two ouches of gold, and two gold rings, and put the two rings in the two ends of the breastplate. And they put the two wreathen chains of gold in the two rings on the ends of the breastplate. And the two ends of the two wreathen chains they fastened to the two ouches, and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod before it. And they made two rings of gold, and put them on the two ends of the breastplate, upon the border of it, which was on the side of the ephod inward. And they made two other gold rings, and put them on the two sides of the ephod underneath, toward the fore part of it, over against the other coupling thereof, made above the curious girdle of the ephod. And they did bind the breastplate by his rings unto the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue, that it might be above the curious girdle of the ephod, and that the breastplate might not be loosed from the ephod, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And he made the robe of the ephod of woven work, all of blue. And there was an hole in the midst of the robe, as the hole of a habergeon, with the band around about the hole, that it should not rend. And they made upon the hems of the robe pomegranates of blue, and purple, and scarlet, and twined linen. And they made bells of pure gold, and put the bells between the pomegranates upon the hem of the robe, round about between the pomegranates, a bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate, round about the hem of the robe to minister in, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And they made coats of fine linen, of woven work for Aharon and his sons, and a mitre of fine linen, and goodly bonnets of fine linen, and fine breeches of fine twined linen, and a girdle of fine twined linen, and blue, and purple, and scarlet of needlework, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. And they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold, and wrote upon it a writing, like the engravings of a signet, Holiness to Yehovah. and they tied up unto it a lace of blue to fasten it on high upon the mitre, as Yehovah commanded Moshe. This was all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation finished. Thus was all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation finished. And the children of Israel did according to all that Yehovah commanded Moshe, so did they. And they brought the tabernacle unto Moshe, the tent and all his furniture, his taches, his boards, his bars, his pillars, and his sockets, and the covering of ram skins dyed red, and the covering of the badger's skins, and the veil of the covering, and the ark of the testimony, and the staves thereof, and the mercy seat, and the table, and all the vessels thereof, and the showbread, and pure candlestick, with the lamps thereof, even with the lamps to be set in order, and all the vessels thereof, and the oil for her light, and the golden altar, and the anointing oil, and the sweet incense, and the hanging for the tabernacle door, and the brazen altar, and his grate of brass, his staves, and all his vessels, the laver and his foot, the hangings for the of the court, his pillars and his sockets, and the hanging for the court gate, his cords and his pins, and all the vessels of the service of the tabernacle, for the tent of the congregation, the clothes of service to do service in the holy place, holy garments for Aharon, the priest, and his son's garments, to minister in the priest's office, according to all that Yehovah commanded Moshe. So the children of Israel made all the work. And Moshe did look upon all the work, and behold, they had done it as Yehovah had commanded. Even so had they done it. And Moshe blessed them. Went all the way to the end of the chapter. And that's where we're going to end up going, instead of just a 32. This week's subject is the coverings of the Mishkan's furnishings, the ephod, breastplate, shoulder boards, and the high priest's service garments. The phrase, as Yehovah commanded Moshe, is used 7 times in this chapter, and its variant, as Yehovah had commanded Moshe, once. This tells me that Moshe got the instructions directly from Yehovah as the work proceeded, and that Bezalel and Aholiab performed the work exactly as Moshe gave the instructions, and that when all the work was inspected, it was exactly as Yehovah had commanded Moshe. I think this shows that Bezalel and Aholiab performed one thing at a time as the orders came from Yehovah through Moshe, and that they did as Ruach inspired them to do. He would assign the task and show the pattern to be duplicated, and then the craftsmen would do exactly as they were instructed. Verse 1 says that they made the clothes of service. Stone's Tanakh says that they made knit vestments for the service. These were made of the blue, purple, scarlet, without fine linen or gold. So it had nothing to do with the ephod of the priests, of the high priest's tunic, which had all 5 textiles woven in, like the Mishkan and the inner veil. Verse 1 is about the coverings for the furnishings of the Mishkan, the ark and the mercy seat, the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the menorah. These had to be covered because they were only for the priest's eyes to behold, and that only within the outer veil. And in the case of the ark, only by the high priest on Yom Kippur, in the Kodesh Kadashim, within the inner veil. I assume that the high priest would place the covering on the ark, and possibly on the other furnishings, for transport when the pillar of cloud was taken up and Israel had to go. Now, the possibility exists, and this is an aside that's not written here, the possibility exists that since the priest could only go into the Holy of Holies once, the Kodesh Kadashim, he could only go in there once in a year, and that not without blood, that he isn't the one who placed the covering over the ark and the mercy seat, but that Yehovah did that himself. Okay, that's something to get your mind around. We'll look into this idea a little bit later. Verses 2 through 3 speak of... are we still hearing me? Show me a 1, please. Okay. Verses 2 and 3 speak of the making of the fabric for the ephod of all the same stuff as the Mishkan and veil. the gold was worked in cunningly. But was it to portray angels as it did in the veil in the Mishkan? This is not specified. It just says that it was cunningly worked in. That could have something to do with the difference in the material, being that this is pure gold and it was rolled or beaten out flat and very thin, and then it was cut into threads, that they had to handle that very differently than the wool, the scarlet, the blue, and the purple wool, and the fine twined linen, because it couldn't take the kind of pressure side to side. Okay, and so working it in cunningly, that may be what they're talking about. But also, it was probably to represent something, and to actually be a likeness of it for people to perceive. But the only person that could perceive it was the priest or the high priest. So, anyway, that's the aside. Verses 4 and 5 speak of the shoulder boards of the ephod made with ouches of gold, each with an onyx stone cut with rabbits around the edges and raised lettering, like they were embossed, cut into the stone like a signet ring. These gold ouches were enclosed, and that's the King James term for it, were enclosed in the fabric ephod. Now, I assume it was a single piece of gold with a molded setting in the base, and a top that folded over the base with a hole to hold the stone in place, like in the breastplate that had 12 holes cut in it. The signet ring was a king's mark placed on a stone inner ring that he or his chamberlain would use to seal the wax on important documents. As an aside, do you suppose, this one's written, do you suppose that maybe how people will be marked in the end of days? By their respective king's signet? Possibly, but not necessarily. In verses 8 through 14, the breastplate was a joint effort of Bezalel and Aholiab. The gold that was cunningly worked into the fabric of the veil, the Mishkan and the high priest garments, was pounded or rolled out to a very fine thickness and then cut into very fine filaments to be woven right into the cloth of the various service items. It doesn't specify that the ephod or tunic had angels woven cunningly into the fabric, but the Mishkan and veil absolutely did. If the threads are listed in order of use, gold was the predominant one by volume, but that would also include the breastplate for the ephod, which was made of a plate of gold, 1 cubit long and a half cubit wide, folded over. In one half was cut the 12 holes, which would fold over to hold the precious stones in place. The other half would probably have settings molded into which the stones would fit more rather snugly. The stones were cut with a kind of rabbet on the edges and the name of the tribe for which the individual stone stood embossed on its exposed surface. The folded over portion of the gold plate would then hold the stones in place, covering the rabbets and exposing the embossed tribal names. The finished breastplate was then a span by a span, a half cubit by a half cubit. I think that this was a normal cubit because it doesn't specify after the cubit of the sanctuary or anything like that. I assume the cubit of the sanctuary is different from the cubit of a man because it will be in Ezekiel's temple, where the cubit is a cubit and a handbreadth, or 1 1/4 cubits, where a cubit of a man is about 18 inches, a span 9 inches, and a handbreadth 4.5. Therefore, I think that a cubit in the Mishkan and the court was equal to about 22.5 inches. This is all assumption and could be incorrect. It could be talking about a normal cubit. The reason I think it may be different is found in two places in the scripture. Okay, number one, in Deuteronomy chapter 3 and verse 11, it says, "For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabeth of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits was the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth of it, after the cubit of a man." This would be 14.5 feet by 6 feet. And then we juxtapose that with Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 5, where it is written, "And behold, a wall on the outside of the house round about, and in the man's hand a measuring reed of 6 cubits long, by the cubit and an hand breadth. So he measured the breadth of the building, one reed, and the height, one reed, in Ezekiel 14, verse 5. Now, a reed in this case equals 11 feet, 3.5 inches, going by a cubit and a hand breadth, being 22.5 inches. Now, why specify a cubit of a man in Deuteronomy 3 and a special cubit in Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 for use in the third Beit HaMikdash, if there were not two different cubits used for different applications, one for general use and one for sacred use? That's what I think, and again, I could be wrong. The breastplate was permanently attached to the ephod with the ropes of gold and the laces of blue. The breastplate was never to be detached. The ephod's robe was all of blue, woven with a head hole right in on the loom, so that the head hole wouldn't tear when the high priest stuck his big head through it. At the bottom of the robe were bells of gold and pomegranates of blue, scarlet, fine linen, and purple woven into the seam. A bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate, in that order. It would go a gold bell, a blue pomegranate, a gold bell, a red pomegranate, a gold bell, a purple pomegranate, a gold bell, and a fine twined linen pomegranate, and then it would repeat. Now, whether the colors were in that order, I don't know, but that's the way they're given. Okay, in verses 27 to 28, they're about the fine linen coats, the headdresses, and the holy underwear of the priests. Then, in verse 29, they made a girdle of the four fabrics to set the Aharonic priests apart from the Levitical priests. In verses 30 to 31, the last thing that the craftsmen made was the crown of gold that attached to the high priest's turban or bonnet. I believe it was a plate of gold with raised lettering like a signet. The relatively thick gold plate was probably carved like the stones had been carved, and was attached by blue laces around the back, from the sides around the back, and then over the top, from the top over the top of the turban, and then the three laces were tied together. Okay? All of the blue we've seen is turquoise blue, which is very like the blue of a clear sky and therefore represents the heavens. The gold, of course, represents purity, majesty, and perfection. The scarlet represents the blood of the covenants, the purple represents royalty, and the fine linen represents the righteous standing of the saints who are clothed in the righteousness of Elohim in or by Moshiach. Starting in verse 32, we see all the stuff of the Mishkan was brought to Moshe to be approved, anointed, and built. Moshe had been there to give the instruction on what to build and what it should look like, and he was the only one who went up the mount and was translated into the throne room of Yehovah and his heavenly tabernacle. In Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5 it reads, "Who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moshe was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed thee in the mount." And then in Hebrews 9 and 23, "It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heaven should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these." But Moshe had no hand in making any of the stuff of the Mishkan. He gave instruction and trusted Ruach to guide the minds and hands of the craftsmen. And when it was done, Moshe looked at it and saw that it was good. Shades of the creation of the universe, eh? In verses 32, 42, and 43, it says the children of Israel did exactly what Yehovah had told them three times. The note on verse 43 in the Chumash is representative of the Orthodox thinking on this. And this you're going to find if you have a Stone's Chumash, the bottom of page 536, under the title, "So They Had Done." And, wait a minute, let me find that. 536, "So They Had Done." This is the third time in the chapter that this expression is used, in verses 32, 42, and 43. The apparent redundancy may allude to the three elements of the sin of the golden calf, for which the Jews atoned by making the tabernacle. They expressed their denial of the Torah in deed by worshiping the calf, in speech by calling it a god, and in thought by believing it to have divine power. In performing their duty to make the tabernacle, they showed their loyalty to God in the same three ways. Indeed, by contributing, in thought, by dedicating their intelligence to the task, and in speech, by declaring throughout the work that they were doing it for the sake of heaven. And that is from Or HaChaim, the Light of Life, one of the rabbis that they love to quote. Okay. We'll see Moshe construct the Mishkan next week. Suffice it to say that the 81-year-old Moshe did not build it alone, although no Israelite helped him. Moshe constructed what he could himself, but to drape the Mishkan curtains over the 18-foot-plus boards took a miracle, as did the placement of the mercy seat on the ark. It weighed at least 214 pounds and was 55 inches long and 34 inches wide, and only Yehovah knows how thick. Kind of unwieldy for Schwarzenegger in his prime, much less Moshe at 81. Okay, that's all I've got on the Torah portion for today, and we are now open to questions and comments. If you have a question or a comment and you have a mic, we'll be more than happy to give that mic to you. Eve, you had your hand up before. Did I go so far as to make it useless to ask the question or make the comment? You are ready. Okay. Then you may have the mic.
Can I be heard? It was an accident. I put it up before, but okay, good. But I have some things. Okay. Here, and this is consistent with the Tanakh as well in Exodus, that we see that Moses is shown the heavenly temple, and he's to build everything after according the pattern that he was shown in the mount. And I want to compare that to what John the Revelator saw as well, because in Revelation John's given a vision, but in particular to the pattern of the temple. Here's what it says in Revelation 21. And you know what, I've discovered that I can't talk too long on the mic because it overloads my internet connection. So if I get disconnected, I'll come back in, and then I'll break my segments down to smaller portions. In Revelation 21, it says, "And he carried me away, John, in the Spirit, to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the Holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." I didn't mean to post that twice. So what I want to do is show you that both Moses and John were taken to the same location, which I believe the high mount was actually, they ascended up into heaven and were shown the things in the heavenlies. And I believe those two verses demonstrate that. Now, what I want to go to back now is our portion and show you what I see as the things that are comparing each other that are very similar in what they saw. So in Exodus 39, first thing that I notice, I find rather interesting, is that when he's describing the garments, and let me see if I can find the right verse because I was looking at several verses. There's one where it talks about gold, purple, scarlet, and fine. I'm going to put in verse 8. In verse 8, they're making the breastplate. It's of cunning work. This is the garment that the high priest is going to wear, and the breastplates of cunning work, like the work of the ephod, of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet, and fine twined linen. And I'm going to focus on what these colors are. So if you compare that to what John saw, John sees in heaven a woman, and a woman, this is the great harlot of Babylon, and this is coming out of Revelation 17. Revelation 17, garment of the high priest, and we see what John sees as the harlot wearing. She doesn't have all the colors, but her clothing is very similar to that of what, okay, I'm going to release the mic for just a time, I think. Yet. Okay, I'm going to release the mic.
Okay, thank you, Eves. So far, you're doing great. I can't wait to see you tie this together. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colors and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Okay, are you ready? You may have it back.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is show you that Moses saw the actual woman, the bride, but yet John gets to see two women. John's going to see the false bride, the harlot, and John's going to see the bride. And you're going to see that Moses is showing us what the bride is decked out. And so here we see in Revelation 17 that the harlot, the one who is acting as the bride until the bride comes, is adorned in the clothing, but it's a replication and it's missing some of the items. For instance, she has the gold, this harlot has the gold, has the purple, has the scarlet, and interestingly enough, she doesn't have any blue in her clothing. But nonetheless, we know that's the harlot. And so I want you to see that the harlot appears as if she is the bride, but she's lacking some of the elements of what the bride has. Now, back to the bride, when I posted the verse that John was taken up to the mount, and let me see if I can get that one back up. Actually, I closed it back down. It says he was shown the, let me scroll up and get it so I can use the exact words. Says, and he carried me away in the spirit into a great and high mountain and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. I'm going to pull up Revelation 21 so I can quote you just a little bit more out of there. And we know that what he's seeing there is the bride of Messiah. And wait until I show you what she's adorned in. I didn't have this when I closed it down. Okay, so he's just given the picture of the bride, and having the glory, and her light was like unto most precious, even a jasper stone clear as crystal. But I'm looking for the verse that's going to tell me. Let me go find it since I don't want to scroll around and read it. She's going to be adorned, as Mark said, in fine linen, fine white linen. And so if you look back at... I found this. Revelation 19. And so he sees the bride, the lamb of the lamb, and her wife has made herself ready, verse 19:7. And this woman, here's what she's decked out in initially. She doesn't have the priestly garments on yet, as Moses.
Sorry, girl, you dropped the mic. You want to come back?
Okay, I'll try one. So we have Revelation 19, where the woman has, this is the bride again, can I be heard? Where the woman has fine linen, and back to the posting of our Torah portion, we see that the bride that Moses has shown has blue and scarlet, I'm looking for my verse, and gold, and she also has fine linen, fine twine linen. So what you're starting to see now is that John is actually seeing the same woman that Moses is seeing, and she's decked out with the same garments here, but she doesn't have, when she comes down and she's descending, she only has the fine twine linen on, the undergarments. For some reason, I would say as she's coming down and descending at this point, I believe it's to fight the battle, she has the undergarments of fine twine linen, but she doesn't have on this breastplate. And I suspect what happens is when she goes to the actual wedding, that's when she puts on, because, and why I'm saying this, is we know that the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, that's when he wore this breastplate. He only went in there once a year, and that was... at Yom Kippur. So after the events of Armageddon play out on Yom Kippur, I suspect that we'll see this woman in fine white breastplate, and she'll be chosen to serve as a priest and king, and then she'll have be adorned in the rest of her clothing. But there's one more point that I would like to show you about the Exodus passage that compares also to Revelation. It has to do with the stones. And I've spoken about this before, but it doesn't make any sense to me yet, the order that the stones in Exodus 39 are laid out. But it says, here's the point I just want to make, because keep in mind, it seems to me that Moses is trying to recreate after the pattern. We know that they saw in heaven. So he says in 39, this breastplate is four squares, that they made the breastplate double, a span of length and width thereof, and the span and breadth thereof being double. And they set it in four rows of stones, and the first row is sardis, topaz, and carbuncle was the first row. So it goes on to outline these 12 stones and the order of them and what it looks like. Now, in Revelation, on the other hand, what you see in John's vision, you see these same types of stones, which I'm convinced are the same exact stones. They just have a slightly different name for a couple of them. But they're described as the foundation. Now, what I don't fully understand how these two tie together, but in Revelation 21, it says that Revelation 29 or 21:19. Let me just post it so you can see it. Here's what I think is actually occurring there. You have Revelation 21. Dang, sorry, my typing's not good today. Let me try 19 again. 19, it says, the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manners of precious stones. And in Exodus 39, you don't see the foundation. You see a breastplate on the high priest. But when I start to think about, well, why does the priest have a breastplate and the foundation of the wall of the city have the foundation, these same stones as their foundation? But if you take in consideration that John is saying that he sees the woman descending out of heaven as the new Jerusalem, what I think we're seeing a picture of is that the new Jerusalem is being compared to this high priest. It's almost as if he's trying to show us, Moses is trying to show us through the high priest, as if he's a picture of what John calls the bride that's descending. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I can't quite express it yet, that we see the high priest with the same stones on his chest, as if you were looking, looking up towards the city that John calls the bride descending down, the new Jerusalem. You should see the foundation. It's almost like that foundation is the breastplate of the high priest that's now descending down. And I can't quite see why that imagery would be used for a breastplate, so I would be curious if anybody sees any other comparisons. So maybe, Mark, you could show me what you see, because I don't understand, but it looks like the city has a breastplate on it, which is called the foundation stones. But I can't quite explain it any more than that, because that's all the imagery I sort of see when I compare the two. And I can't quite understand what they're trying to show to us. But I am convinced that they're trying to show us the same thing, given that Moses was trying to replicate after the pattern of what he was shown. And I am convinced that John the Revelator was shown the exact same thing.
Well, I think that John was in the throne room just like Moshe was. I believe that they saw pretty much the same thing. I don't necessarily agree that the foundations is the breastplate. However, I do agree that they're trying to metaphorically show the same truth. Okay? And that's why the stones are very similar. There's also a breastplate in Revelation. I can't remember exactly where it is. Pretty sure there's a breastplate in there. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm just thinking out loud and not thinking straight. Let me see here. Breastplate. And let's go to the last, that's for the last one, is in Thessalonians. Never mind, no breastplate in Revelation. that can't be it. But anyway, I think that the stones are showing are metaphors for the tribes and also the character of those particular tribes. that's the way that I see that anyway, and I see how that just works together with what you were talking about there. I don't see them as exactly the same application, but I do see them as the same metaphor. Therefore, it makes sense to me. Are there other questions or comments? We had a guy come in and say he had a question and then he left. If there are no other questions or comments, we shall move on. We're done with our Torah portion already. Okay, well, then we'll go and have a look at 1 Kings chapter 7. That's 1 Melachim chapter 7. And let's see. 1 Kings 7. And beginning in verse 13. And it says, "And King Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in brass, and he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning to work all works of brass. And he came to King Solomon and wrought all his work, for he cast two pillars of brass of 18 cubits high apiece, and a line of 12 cubits did compass either of them about. And he made two chapiters, or capitals, of molten brass, to set upon the tops of the pillars, and the height of one chapiter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other chapiter was 5 cubits, and nets of checker work, and wreaths of chain work, for the chapiters were made upon the tops of the pillars, 7 for the one chapiter, and 7 for the other chapiter, and he made the pillars, and 2 rows round about upon the one chapiter, or no, network rather, to cover the chapiters that were upon the top, with pomegranates. And so did he for the other chapiter. And the chapiters were upon the top of the pillars, that were upon the top of the pillars, were of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. And the chapiters upon the 2 pillars had pomegranates also above, over against the belly, which was by the, which was by the network, and the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the other chapiter. And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar, and called the name thereof Yechin, and he set up the left pillar, and called the name thereof Boaz. And upon the top of the pillars was lily work, so was the work of the pillars finished. And he made a molten sea, 10 cubits from the one brim to the other. It was round all about, and his height was 5 cubits, and a line of 30 cubits did compass it round about. And under the brim of it, round about, there were knops, compassing it, 10 and a cubit, compassing the sea round about. The knops were cast in 2 rows, when it was cast. It stood upon 12 oxen, 3 looking toward the north, and 3 looking toward the west, and 3 looking toward the south, and 3 looking toward the east. And the sea was set above upon them, and all their hinder parts were inward. And it was an handbreadth thick, and the brim thereof was wrought like the brim of a cup, with flowers of lilies. It contained 2,000 baths. And he made 10 bases of brass. 4 cubits was the length of one base, and 4 cubits the breadth thereof, and 3 cubits the height of it. And the work of the bases were on this manner. They had borders, and the borders were between the ledges. And on the borders that were between the ledges were lions, oxen, and cherubims. And upon the ledges there was a base thereof, above. And beneath the lions and oxen were certain additions made of thin work. And every base had 4 brass wheels, and plates of brass, and the 4 corners thereof had undersetters. Under the laver were undersetters molten at the side and every addition." Now I believe, I'm stopping here for a second, I believe that the undersetters are like chocks that hold the wheels in place. Okay? So that's my little addition there. And the mouth of it within the chapiter and above was a cubit. But the mouth thereof was round after the work of the base, a cubit and a half. And also upon the mouth of it were gravings with their borders, four square, not round. And under the borders were four wheels, and the axle trees of the wheels were joined to the base. And the height of the wheel was a cubit and a half cubit. And was a cubit and half a cubit. And the work of the wheels was like the work of a chariot wheel. Their axle trees and their naves and their fellows and their spokes were all molten. And there were four undersetters to the four corners of the one base, and the undersetters were of the very base itself. And in the top of the base was there a round compass of half a cubit high. And on the top of the base, the ledges thereof and the borders thereof were of the same. For on the plates of the ledges thereof and on the borders thereof he graved cherubims, lions, and palm trees, according to the proportion of every one, and additions round about. After this manner he made the 10 bases. All of them had one casting, one measure, and one size. Then made he 10 labors of brass. One labor contained 40 baths, and every labor was 4 cubits, and upon every one of the 10 bases, one labor. And he put 5 bases on the right side of the house, and 5 on the left side of the house. And he set the sea on the right side of the house, eastward, over against the south. And Hiram made the labors and the shovels and the basins. So Hiram made an end of doing all the work that he made King Solomon for the house of Jehovah. And the 2 pillars and the 2 bowls of the chapiters that were on the top of the 2 pillars, and the 2 networks to cover 2 bowls of the chapiters, which were upon the top of the pillars, and 400 pomegranates for the 2 networks, even 2 rows of pomegranates for 1 network, to cover the 2 bowls of the chapiters that were upon the pillars, and the 10 bases and the 10 labors on the bases, and 1 sea and 12 oxen under the sea, and the pots and the shovels and the basins and all these vessels which Hiram made to King Solomon for the house of Jehovah were of bright brass. In the plain of Jordan did the king cast them, and in the clay ground between Sukkot and Zarthan. And Solomon left all the vessels unweighed, because they were exceeding many. Neither was the weight of the brass found out. Then Solomon made all the vessels that pertained unto the house of Jehovah, the altar of gold, and the table of gold, whereupon the showbread was, and the candlesticks of pure gold, 5 on the right side and 5 on the left, before the oracle, with the flowers and the lamps and the tongues of gold, and the bowls and the snuffers and the basins and the spoons and the censers of pure gold, and the hinges of gold, both for the doors of the inner house, and the most holy place, and for the doors of the house, to wit, of the temple. So was ended all the work that King Solomon made for the house of Jehovah. And Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold and the vessels, which he put among the treasures of the house of Jehovah. Shlomo had his own Bezalel. His name was Hiram, a son of the Israelite woman and of the tribe of Naphtali. Was he the same Hiram who would be king of Lebanon? Possibly, but I am unsure. He is not the Hiram who was David's ally and who sent an embassage to Shlomo on his ascension to the throne of Israel, but he may have been the son of Hiram and the heir to the throne. When I wrote that, I wasn't thinking about that first line where it says that he was the son of a widow. Okay, and so at this particular time he was widowed, and so he was not the king Hiram's son. So that's a little correction. The kings in those days earned their place by their savvy, either in war making or in business. Now I think Hiram may have been both. And if David's friend was a businessman, he probably trained his son to work and to be as good at his chosen field as he could be. A metal worker, like a gold, silver, or even brass smith, I think there would be good money in it. And that is meant as an understatement, by the way, that there would be good money in being a goldsmith or a silversmith. the first things that Hiram made for Shlomo were Yechin, he will set up, that's what that word means, and Boaz, likely means in strength, from the word Boaz. The pillars that held nothing up, but stood at the entrance of Shlomo's temple, or the Beit HaMikdash. These pillars were 12 cubits in circumference and 18 cubits high. The formula for the circumference of a circle is 2 pi r, so the pillars were each roughly 44 inches in outside diameter. Now, assuming that the brass to be as thick as the brass of the molten sea, a handbreadth, 4 and a half inches, the interior diameter was about 35 inches. And the volume of each of these things is humongous. They're 18 cubits high, 27 feet tall, with chapiters on top, okay? And they're hollow. That's given, as that much solid brass would have been next to impossible to move, much less lift into place. Besides, after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, the pillars were lying on their sides and the solid brass capitals, or chapiters, nearby. Here the capitals are recorded as being 5 cubits high, here in our passage today. But in 2 Kings, chapter 25, they are only 3 cubits high when the pillars are standing, but 5 cubits when they're lying down. Where do those 2 cubits go? What's the solution to the problem? There was something inside the pillars holding them up there until Babylon came into town. And when they came to the temple, there were settled 2 whole cubits further into the pillars. Now, whatever was inside before wasn't there anymore. Now, Michael Rood's idea of a sand hydraulic elevator system to remove the ark and other furniture to safety helps explain where they went now, doesn't it? Is it true? Yehovah only knows. But it is possible. In doing a bit of research on Boaz, the word Boaz, I found that Oz means taking refuge or finding safety. So Yachin Boaz means he will set up in refuge or safety. Curiouser and curiouser. Do you suppose that Shlomo had knowledge of the end days of his kingdom and made arrangements to have the ark and other furnishings removed to safety quickly? Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3 says, "A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." Now, who wrote that? Oh! Shlomo wrote that, didn't he? That's right. When the sand ballast was gone, and hollow brass pillars were made very top-heavy with the 5 cubits of solid brass, nearly 3 cubits in diameter, resting on top. A relatively mild earthquake, or a block and tackle and sturdy rope could have brought them down almost without effort. In verses 23 through 26, here is Hiram in the molten sea. A line of 30 cubits stretches around the sea, and one of 10 cubits stretches across it. That's pretty close to exactly right. In fact, it may be exactly the volume of the water in the sea, if the 10 cubits is the inside diameter of the sea. The molten sea is a sphere cut in half with an outside circumference of 30 cubits, or 56.3 feet. 63 feet, 3 inches, I should say. And a radius of 112 and a half inches, 5 cubits, or 9 feet, 3 and a half inches, with walls 4 and a half inches thick. This thing was humongous as well. The volume of this half sphere is roughly 9,000 gallons, or 2,000 baths. So a bath is 4.5 gallons. Those, by the way, are things that are given to us in the thing. So the sea sat upon the backs of the 12 brass oxen, 4 sets of 3 facing in the cardinal directions, symbolizing the tribes and their camps, or the gates to the New Jerusalem, or both. Verses 27 through 39, Hiram made 10 identical bases of brass, 7 feet by 7 feet and 5.5 feet high, for 12 brass lavers, each holding 180 gallons of water. The number 10 deals with divine governmental completeness. Perhaps it has also to do with the 10 tribes of the north somehow. Or perhaps it speaks of the 10 Sephirot, if you want to look again at the Tree of Sephirot at Zion.org, which there's the link for it in these 10 emanations, if you will. And the definition of an emanation, by the way, is something emitted that is abstract but perceptible. Okay, so an emanation of El Shaddai. These are things that are abstract to our thinking, but they are perceptible by looking at his creation, and that's what the Tree of Sephirot is meant to be. Okay, the undersetters are like chocks that make the stuff immobile. In verse 41, we get another detail for the pillars. They have bowls on top. Perhaps that's the lily work from earlier in the chapter. Do you think the bowls could be a kind of funnel to help add the ballast of sand? There was so much brass in verse 47 used that they didn't even bother counting or weighing it. Suffice it to say that the brass was of prodigious mass. The ark, the table of the showbread, the menorot, 10 of them, Sephirot again, tribes of the north again, perhaps, and the altar, as well as the utensils for the service in the sanctuary, were made of pure gold. So Shlomo brought all the stuff that David had set apart to Yehovah's service in the temple, and all that Shlomo had made into the temple for dedication. And we're in exactly the same place in the tabernacle, or the temple here, as we were in the tabernacle at the end of our reading today. All of the stuff has been made, and it's now ready to be dedicated. Okay? And that's where our Haftarah ends for today. Now, if there are questions or comments, we're open to them. If you have a question or comment and you have a mic, be more than happy to have you raise your hand and we'll give it to you. If not, put something in the text and maybe we can figure something out for you. Okay. Pi equals 3.141759, something like that. It's a little bit more than it goes on forever. There's no end to that particular equation. I believe that equation is 10 into I forget. Anyway, Eves, you may go. Yeah, there you go, Moshiach. Now, Eves Garden. What happened?
Must have left. There's one more comment. Sorry to take a sec. I want to show one more thing about that high mount that John and Moses went to. Satan took Yeshua to it as well. And it's interesting because in Luke 4:5, I believe that what Satan did was offer Yeshua exactly what we were talking about. It said, and the devil, taking him up into a high mountain, showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in the moment of a time. And the devil said unto him, all this power will I give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me to whomsoever I will give it. And so, if John was seeing the bride, you see that Satan was taken up that same mount where Moses was shown. And interestingly enough, the kingdoms of the world, if you think about that Daniel statue, Babylon, the Medes and Persians, Greeks, Romans, and then the ten toes, all the kingdoms of the world, even beyond that, if there are others, which there are, Satan, since he is the prince of the air, the prince of this world, has the right, it says in Luke, to deliver those kingdoms, that harlot bride that was decked out like the bride, but not the bride that John described. Satan, at that point, when he took him out into the 40 days, offered that to him as his bride. And Satan, by the way, appears to have the authority, because it says, for that is delivered unto me. All those kingdoms are delivered unto Satan, and to whomsoever I will give it. And in the end, you will see him give it to the false Messiah for a time. He gives his kingdoms over to the false Messiah. That's why the ten kings then the seven kings are turned over to one as their head. But I just want to point out that the high mountain, Yeshua was also taken there and offered. He also got to see the same perspective that these two saw as well. And I'm going to review Kings real quick and maybe make a comment on it. I release the mic.
Yes, a geometry lesson, Rip Van. those are just things that came out of my tree-addled memory. Yes, one huge swimming pool of a labor. That's correct, Sunny Sunflower. It was a great big thing. I mean, it'll hold 9,000 gallons. Now, you know, it's not a swimming pool. The idea is that you, but there was a, in the temple, there were going to be a lot of offerings, and all the offerings had to be washed in the laver. Okay, and you know, there had to be a lot of ramps getting up to it, so that the priests could carry the meat up there to wash, so that they could wash their own hands and feet before they went into the to offer the offerings. I mean, it was huge. It was just massive. I mean, you're talking about 10 cubits across. If it's a royal cubit, you're talking about 225 inches across, almost 20 feet. Well, 18 and change feet. That would mean that it's 9 feet deep in the center as well, because it's 5 cubits for that. I mean, it's massive. Absolutely massive. Now, Michael Rood went on and he said you could put so many eggs in that. You know, I don't know where that came from, but, or why he even bothered with that. But, it was he that came up with the idea of the, at least in my estimation, the first place I heard it, of the sand hydraulics, and using the pillars as, sand holders, if you will. And, you know, once the sand was gone out of them, they were very, very top heavy. Okay? And of mild shaking would have knocked them over. But while the sand was in them, they've got a good ballast to hold them in place. So. Four thirds pi r cubed is the volume of a sphere. Moshiach, no. You're getting way beyond what I'm interested in anyway. Okay. Are there other questions or comments on the Yiska, good to see you. Says hello from northern Minnesota. Well, I'm sorry that the Sukkot didn't work out up there, but you know, you can always come down here. We're gonna have one here. So at least a gathering. And it'll be kind of laid back, so we're looking forward to that. No, the animals weren't washed before killing. No, they were the meat was rinsed, I believe, and the priest had to wash to get the blood off of him. So they would put the meat on a plate of a brass plate. And they would bring it up and they would wash the thing off, and then they would wash themselves, and they would take the plate in over to the altar to offer it. That's my understanding anyway. If anyone has a more correct way of looking at that or explaining it, I would be more than happy to give you the mic. Yeah, the temple Solomon's temple was incredibly massive. You know, we were talking about the Mishkan in the Torah portion, and remember that the Mishkan, the Holy of Holies, is technically the Mishkan. Okay, it's the draping, the first draping over top, that was technically the Mishkan, although the whole place was called the tabernacle. But the Holy of Holies was 10 cubits by 10 cubits. And the Holy of Holies in temples, in Solomon's temple, was 20 cubits by 20 cubits. So you could fit four of the Mishkans into the Kodesh Kodashim in Solomon's temple. A cubit is a unit of measure. The cubit of a man, as we spoke of earlier, is about the distance from a man's elbow to the end of his middle finger. Okay, the longest length there, and it's 18 to 21 inches, correct. Generally, it's taken to be 18 inches. A royal cubit, as we see in Ezekiel's temple, is a cubit and a hand breadth. So you put your hand on top of that thing and measure that, it comes to about 22 and a half to 25 inches. So two different cubits spoken of. I believe in the temple it's talking about the one that we see in Ezekiel and also in the Mishkan. And when you're talking about just a guy, like we spoke of Og of Bashan, and he had that 9 cubit long bed, okay, that's talking about a human cubit, which is 18 inches roughly. So that's the way I see that anyway. Eve's Garden. You just put your hand up. I would just love to give you the mic. Go for it, girl.
I'm fulfilling Torah. I didn't read this until just now real quick. I haven't read this for a couple of years. When I'm reading it, what is it that's being built? Tell us again. I might have missed that because I got kicked off. And because in 1 Kings 7, it starts about Solomon building his own house for 13 years. And then he built the house of the forest of Lebanon. What's the house? What's being referred to, the house of the forest of Lebanon? And then it also describes in 8, he built a house for Pharaoh's daughter, who was his wife. It says, likened to this porch. So as we proceed on down through that and we're reading 13 through 51, will you tell me again what is actually being built? This is part of what property? I release the mic.
Okay, it's Solomon's temple. The brass lavers, the 10 brass lavers, are... Let me give it to you this way. As you walked into the temple precinct, okay, the entire enclosure, you walked into the court, and just inside the court was the altar of burnt offering. Then you would walk further on towards the Kodesh place and the Kodesh Kodeshim. And you'd walk on there, and there would be the 10 lavers, the 10 bases and the 10 lavers. And then get to the end of that, you would come to the molten sea. Okay? Then you would move on to that, through the first veil, and you would come into the holy place. And then you would walk through, then the high priest once a year would walk through the inner veil to the Ark of the Covenant, where he would offer the blood for the atonement. So we're talking about the entire temple precinct, not just the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Okay, and these are the brazen lavers. This is correct. For the washing of the meat and not the priest, I believe so. And I believe that the brazen sea was for the priest to wash in. And again, I think it's because of the sheer volume of sacrificial service that they're going to be doing in this temple. Because by this time, Israel was not just 6,000 men or 600,000 men. It was millions. And every time they went up for the feasts, they had to have, you know, no one went up to the feasts empty-handed. They went up with an offering. Imagine the size of a cow. the offerings were specified what, you know, certain parts of the bull, certain parts of the sheep that were offered, and the rest was taken home and eaten. This is all my understanding. I could be wrong. There might be somebody out there with a better idea of what's going on, and I'd be more than happy to listen to what they have to say. No, I don't think so, but I could be proven wrong. I do believe that someone has done that at one time or another, but I don't remember when. Okay. My dog just came to visit me. Gave her a bath yesterday. She smells and feels good for a change. Okay, are there other questions or comments on the Torah or the Haftarah? All right. And we shall move to the Psalm. You hear her panting. She does that a lot. Yeah, you're a good girl, Nikita. She's a good dog. She helped save my life last year, you know. Okay, Psalm 68:1. Through the end, we're going to go through the whole thing here. So let me get to the Psalm here for a second. Let's say a Psalm 68. Let Elohim arise. Yes. Let his enemies be scattered. Let them also that hate him flee before him. As smoke is driven away, so drive them away. As wax melteth before the fire, so let the wicked perish of the presence of Elohim. But let the righteous be glad. Let them rejoice before Elohim. Yea, let them exceedingly rejoice. Sing unto unto Elohim. Sing praises to his name. Extol him that rideth upon the heavens by his name Yah. And rejoice before him. The father of the fatherless. And a judge of the widows is Elohim in his holy habitation. Elohim setteth the solitary in families. He bringeth out those that are bound with chains, but the rebellious dwell in a dry land. O Elohim, when thou wentest forth before thy people, when thou didst march through the wilderness, Selah. Remember when we're thinking about now. We're thinking about when he went before the people and when they did march through the wilderness. The earth shook. The heavens also dropped at the presence of Elohim. Even Sinai itself at the presence of Elohim, the Elohim of Israel. Thou, O Elohim, didst send a plentiful rain, whereby thou didst confirm thine inheritance when it was weary. Thy congregation hath dwelt therein. Thou, O Elohim, hast prepared of thy loving kindness for the poor. Adonai gave the word. Great was the company of those that published it. Kings of armies did flee apace, and she that tarried at home divided the spoil. Though ye have lain among the pots, the wings of a dove covered with silver, and her feathers with yellow gold. When the Almighty scattered kings in it, it was as snow in Salmon. The hill of Elohim, the hill of Bashan, and high hill is the hill of Bashan. Why leap ye, ye high hills? The hill of Elohim, which Elohim desireth to dwell in, yea, Yehovah will dwell in it forever. the chariots of Elohim, 20,000, even thousands of angels. Adonai is among them. Sinai in the holy. Thou hast ascended on high. Thou hast led captivity captive. Thou hast received gifts for men. Yea, for the rebellious also, that Yehovah Elohim did dwell among them. Blessed be Yehovah, who daily loadeth us with benefits, even the Elohim of our salvation, Selah. Our Elohim is Elohim of salvation, and unto Elohim, Yehovah, Adonai, belong the issues from death. But Elohim shall wound the head of his enemies, the hairy scalp of such an one as goeth on still in his trespasses. Adonai said, I will bring again from Bashan, I will bring again from the depths of the sea, that thy foot may be dipped in the blood of enemies, and the tongue of thy dogs in the same. They have seen thy groanings, O Elohim, thy goings, O Elohim, the goings of my Elohim, my King, in the sanctuary. The singers went forth, the players on instruments, after. Among were the damsels, playing with timbrels. Bless ye Elohim in the congregations, Adonai from the fountain of Israel. There is little Benjamin, their ruler, the prince of Yehuda, their council, the princes of Zebulun, and the princes of Naphtali. Thy Elohim hath commanded thy strength. Strengthen, O Elohim, that which thou hast wrought for us. Because of thy temple at Jerusalem shall kings bring presents unto thee. Rebuke the company of spearmen, the multitude of the bulls, with the calves of the people. Submit himself with pieces of silver. Scatter thou the people that delight in war. Princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands unto Elohim. Sing unto Elohim, ye kingdoms of the earth. O sing praises unto Adonai, Selah. To him that rideth upon the heavens of heavens of old, lo, he doth send out his voice, a mighty voice. Ascribe ye strength unto Elohim, his excellency over Israel, and his strength in the clouds. O Elohim, terrible out of thy holy places, the Elohim of Israel, he that giveth strength and power unto people, blessed be Elohim. A lot of references that we spoke of this past week at our gathering on this past second day, Monday. We had a teaching about the resurrection, and I should say the rapture, so-called. And anyway, it was very, very good. We went into a lot of different areas. We love rabbit trails when we teach. Whenever the word arise is used in verse 1, I think of resurrection. Up, listen to this. You'll remember this from days gone by. Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph for his foes. He arose the victor from the dark domain, and he lives forever with his saints to reign. Ran out of breath. And I got scratchiness in my throat. Anyway, let Elohim arise. Let all his enemies flee from before him. Yehovah Elohim arose in the person of Yeshua. That is not to say that Yehovah died with Yeshua, for it is impossible for the Almighty to die. But he raised Yeshua from the dead and lives in him to this day and forever. In verse 4, we can see that it is not forbidden to use the sacred name. Even the stone's Tanakh says, sing to God, make music to his name. Extol he who rides upon the highest heavens with his name, Yah, and exult before him. The note there says, he guides and directs the servants, or the heavens, as the rider on his steed. Praise him with his name, Yah, which denotes him as the creator and sustainer of the universe. And there is none other who is the creator and sustainer of the universe than Yehovah, Yeshua. He is the creator. Not the physical body of Yeshua as the creator, but the Elohim that indwelt him. In verse 5, we are admonished to care for the widows and orphans, for in so doing, we are most like Yeshua and Jehovah. In verse 6, he tells us that he takes the widow and orphan, assigning them a family to care for their needs. He delivers his own from their bondage, but leaves the rebellious in their exile. In that they were in exile, I infer that these were his at one time, have since turned away, and reap the consequences of their rebellion. In verses 7 through 9, he went forth before us, shaking the earth and lowering the heavens to testify to his great power before the enemy. He provided all of our needs in the wilderness, food, water, spiritual sustenance. The rain that he sent was both physical and spiritual. When we get weary of our daily burdens, he sends a refreshing rain of whatever we who are following him need at that time. Our burden is shown in verse 11, sharing the glad tidings of deliverance to Shalom by our Yehovah. In verse 13, the word lain is the past perfect of the word lie, as in to lie prostrate. It refers to Yeshua lying dead in the grave for 3 days and three nights, but rising as a dove arrayed in splendor, as in verse 1. The hill of Elohim is obviously Zion, where Yehovah will dwell forever. In verse 18, we see Yeshua raised to his majesty on high, having led captivity captive. I think that this speaks at least partially of the early first fruits when Yeshua took the contingent of his Abba as the Bikurim of the dead. In Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 14, where it says, "Therefore hell hath enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure, and their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he that rejoiceth shall descend into it." And then in verse 9 and 10 of Ephesians chapter 4, "Now that he ascended, what is it but that he hath descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same which also ascended up far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things." Baruch Yehovah Yeshuenu, who loads us daily with benefits. What has he done for you today? Selah. What has he done for you today? Selah. Verses 20 through 25 are one answer to that question. He has made you an issue from death. If you are his, spiritual death has been defeated for you, and physical death will be fully defeated in just a very short time. In verses 22 and 23, Yehovah foretells the deliverance of Israel from their Babylonian dispersion 400 years before they even go into exile, and then extends that prophecy to the end of days, the days that I think we are in now. The dogs and the enemy have seen what he can do, and they are scared spitless. That's with a P, spitless. And what are we doing while he is defeating his enemies? We're singing, playing on instruments, and dancing before him who is going to fight for us. We talked about the clouds of heaven this past Monday. Those of you that were there remember. The clouds of heaven has to do with, by the way, there are two clouds, okay, that we spoke of. One cloud is the cloud of angels, and the second cloud is the cloud of witnesses. That's us, the cloud of witnesses that are raised at that just before Yeshua returns. They are raised to meet Yehovah in the air and Yeshua in the air and to come back and reign on this earth. Okay. What are we doing while he's defeating his enemies? We're singing, we're playing, we're dancing before him. We won't even pick up a stone to put in a sling. He is the one that does the fighting. The two houses are depicted in Little Benjamin and Yehuda, and in Zebulun and Naphtali. Are those pieces of silver in verse 30, the half shekels for the maintenance of the temple? Remember it says that the kings and the princes come and they offer their silver. Are the kings of the earth coming up to Jerusalem year by year to give their temple tax of half an ounce of silver? And I say amen to scattering those who delayed in war later on in the chapter. May their designs come to naught in our day as well. Our strength is from a Venus Ruach in us. Yehovah is why and how we stand. It's not of ourselves. I very quickly went through the psalm there, and that's all I've got on it. So if you have questions or comments on anything that was in the psalm, raise your hand and take the mic, or put it in the text. He allowed me to breathe for another year and a half so far. Not just another day. Questions or comments? If you have a salient comment, we're more than happy to hear it. Pick up your hand, raise your hand and take the mic. Eves, your hand is up. Why don't you go ahead and take it?
Okay. I hope other people come up too, because when you speak on the mic, it causes me to see things that I can't see with my own eyes that the Spirit of God hasn't revealed. And it's almost, it helps me to see differently, see things that I haven't seen. And then something new comes in me, so I really like it when you guys share. But in verse 15 and 16, since I've been talking about this mount where Moses was taken, where John was taken, where I believe Yeshua was taken, that's what I think is being spoken of here. If we were to substitute the word, and I haven't gotten a look to see what Hebrew word hill is there, but if we were to substitute that same context, the mountain of the Lord, or Zion, or the mount, which was spoken of in those other three instances that I spoke of. The mount of God is the mount, is as the mount of Bashan, as a high mount. Remember, that's where Yeshua was taken, that's where John and Moses was taken, to a high mount. And so then I'd go back and look and see what happened at Bashan, but I wasn't really going to speak, so I didn't pull it up. And so we see that he wants, it says, this is the hill which God desired to dwell in. Yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever. So, once again, when John saw the mountain of the Lord, or the New Jerusalem, descending down, adorned as a bride, and she had made herself ready, it has, in my opinion, two applications, in that it truly is a physical location, the New Jerusalem, but is also where his people are, and he dwells in them. So we see here in this psalm that he's wanting to dwell. Please don't spam. He's wanting to dwell in the same location where they have seen. And I'll release the mic at this time.
Does the hill represent the Mount of Olives? I think probably better it represents Zion, but you're talking about when he returns, where Yeshua will set his feet. His foot is going to come to rest, and on the Yom Kippur someday soon. Oh, by the way, it's Yom Kippur. Yam is a sea. Yom is a day. When we see Y-O-M, we anglicize it. But that's just one of those things that we ought to watch out for, I think, so that we don't get misunderstood. Eves, you have your hand back up. You may take the mic.
If I stayed in the South any longer, I would might say Yom Kippur, like those sweet potatoes. I agree with Mark. It's talking about Zion, the New Jerusalem. Because in Revelation 21, because keep in mind, when Moses and John and Yeshua are taken up to this mountain, Mount, they're probably actually there in New Jerusalem, in my opinion, because why else would Satan offer from this perspective, takes him up to this highest mount, and he shows him instead of, he shows what Satan has dominion over. Over, and it said, in a moment of time, he showed him all the kingdoms. So it wasn't like he was looking on, he was standing at the top of Mount Everest and looking down at the forest. He said, in a moment of time, he showed him all the kingdoms. So he was able to show him kingdoms that had come and gone since the beginning of time. So whatever he's looking at was an eternal, maybe like outside of time where God exists, and a picture that showed him all the kingdoms in a moment of time. So that's sort of what you see when they're taken up to New Jerusalem. When John goes up, he sees a vision of what it is going to be in the future. He's actually there looking, as if he is there, looking at this New Jerusalem. And so whenever we're talking about this New Jerusalem, it's compared to as a bride for her husband, or she's made herself ready. So we know that that's Zion. Mount of Olives is still the actual place where he puts his feet down when he touches down. It's a literal place on this earth, whereas Zion is something that is yet to appear, yet to come into our reality, in my opinion. I release the mic.
Thank you, Eves. Yes, Barak Yahu, he's, Moshiach now has given you a good, Barak Yahu, he's given you a good comment there. The rabbis don't really believe that Adonai is his name. They use that as a substitute for his name so that they won't take it in vain. There are two ways to look at vain. One is that you use it, and this is from a rabbinic standpoint, okay? This is how they describe it. Vain can be saying something that is really obvious, okay, about something, okay? Like something that's made of wood and saying, this thing is made of wood. It's unnecessary for you to say it, and therefore it's a vain use. Also, to take a thing that is obviously made of wood and say that it's made of gold is a vain usage of the language, because you're obviously lying. And so in those two things, something that is obviously true, you're using something in vain. Saying something that's obvious a lie is also using something in vain. And so that's how the rabbis teach that third commandment, you know, not to use his name in vain. And so to escape any possibility of doing that, they just don't use his name. We know that his name is Yod Heh Vav Heh. Okay, that's, and he used it almost 7,000 times in the Tanakh. And the idea that he used it gives me the impression, and he used it so many times, gives me the impression that he wants us to use it. But he doesn't want to use it vainly. That is to not only what the rabbis have said, but to make it so common in our head that it means nothing. And so, you know, we use the name here, and I probably used it 15 or 20 times in my notes today, but it always is referring to the Almighty, always. And there are different aspects of the Almighty that we use it to speak of as well. But it's the Almighty to whom we pray and in whom we have our being. And so I don't think there's any problem with actually using his name. It's making it something that's so common make its use useless. That's what using his name in vain is. That's what I think anyway. The word God is a title. Yes. And to say that he's the God of Abraham, that's not a problem. But, you know, to refer to him as God is really not a problem, as long as you're not doing that to the point where you're just making his real name useless. You know what I mean? Okay, are there, we got way off on a tangent there, but. See, I like to use, the Almighty. That's a good one. To not actually use his name and to refer to him. Because there aren't very many people who can be called, there are no people who can be called the Almighty. There's only one who can be the Almighty. And that is the En Sof, the one who is unknowable because he's without border. He's without end. You know, I think I did it last week. Or maybe I'm going to do it this week. Come to think of it, I think it's coming right up. So I won't go there. Yeah, it is. It's coming right up in my Brit Hadashah portion for today. So I'm not going to go there right now. But, you know, he's absolutely without end. And so there's no way that we can really and truly ever understand him, because he's without end. You know? So the Almighty, that's the closest thing you can get to telling him is. You know? And his name, Yehovah, is a wonderful thing, and it relates specifically to his goodness, his chesed, his wisdom. You know? So, anyway, I did go off on a tangent, and I don't even know how I did that, but. Yeah, your text note there is true, Servant 60. However, I don't have a problem with people using the term Jesus either. I know who they're referring to. I know to whom they refer more often than not. And I know who I think of when I hear that word. That's the Yeshua who paid the price for me. You know? He's the one with whom I'm clothed. So I don't have a problem with people using that. Although I prefer to use his real name, because that's his name, Yeshua. So, yeah. Exactly right, Sunflower. You are exactly right. That's the name that I got saved by and healed. Exactly right. Question about the verse from Ephesians 4:9. Why did Yeshua have to descend first? Well, it wasn't Yeshua that descended first. It was the Spirit of Elohim who descended. That was the spirit of Yeshua. Yeshua was, his body was 100% human. Okay? But his spirit was not a typical human spirit. It was the Spirit of Elohim dwelling within him. Okay, so it was, so when the body of Yeshua was dead, it was laying in a grave for 3 days and three nights. And during that time, the Spirit of Elohim went and took captivity captive. To descend is, again, is not talking about a physical descent either. We're talking about he went to the place where those people were in exile. He went out to the exile and he brought the exile home. Okay? That's the way I understand. Oh, we've got a couple of people with hands up. Baruch Yahu, you have your hand up. Please go ahead and take the mic.
Comment a while ago about the Sones Kumash even agrees that you should use his actual name in song. But to a rabbinical Jew that rules his life by what the rabbis say, Yah is as close as they'll ever get to that name. When they, I forget what verse it is, when it goes Yah, and then they'll go Adonai. They'll say Yah Adonai rather than Yah Yahweh. They would never use his full name. Number one, they don't believe that anybody knows it, even though it's in a lot of our names, minus the last vowel. And one other comment is that Yeh is a prefix. That means he will. Or he or she will. But when you're talking about God, you're assuming that it's a he. So it's he will. And Hova means to destroy. So when one says Yehovah, you're saying his name is he will destroy. Which is exactly opposite of what people believe the, I'm going to say, tetragrammaton means, which is the creator, or to create, or he was, he is, he will be, he causes to be, he maintains to be. Anyway, your mic.
That was good. Thank you. Eventually, he will destroy. He won't destroy by an action to destroy, but he will destroy by just ceasing to speak. Because he's right now, he's using the same power that he used to create the world to sustain it. And when he ceases to speak the creative word, it's done. It goes away. Eve's Garden, you have your hand up. You may take the mic.
I would like to talk about this verse. I like this verse. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them, as in Sinai, in the holy place. There are two points there, and one of them we talked about, like Mark said at a Bible study. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. And there are many times, and by the way, that says to me when I read it, the chariots of God are angels. And then it also tells how many myriads there are. And throughout the Tanakh and the New Testament, you'll see that there are thousands upon thousands. Sometimes even these angels are, in my opinion, are called saints, which we would normally think of saints as humans, but in some instances I think they're referring to angels. And let me show you something. In the New Testament, it says that when Yeshua gave the law, that there's actually a couple references to this. I only have one of them pulled up. It was by the disposition of angels. This comes out of Acts 7. And I'm going to post it in for you. That here's what it says in Acts 7. Who have received the law by the disposition of angels and have not kept it. And there are some, probably three or four different passages in the New Testament that, first of all, show that it's the law.
Looks like you dropped the mic, Eves. Raise your hand and take it back. Eves, you were in the middle of a sentence on Acts chapter 7, verse 53. Go ahead and take the mic, Eves. I guess she doesn't want to. Oh, she left the room again. I'm going to go ahead and lock this mic up. Okay. Are there any other questions or comments, pardon me, on anything that we've spoken of so far today? I'm guessing not. And so we'll move on to the New Testament portion for today. Brit Hadashah, which is Ivrit, or Hebrews, chapter 8, and verses 1 through 5. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1. Let brotherly love continue. I'm sorry, that's 13. Ah, here we go. Now the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest, who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the master has pitched, and not men. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices. Wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God that he was about to make the when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed thee in the mount. Chapter 7 of Hebrews expounds on the Melchizedek high priest, the Melchizedek high priest of Yeshua. And verse 8 explains that the last seven chapters, or rather what those seven chapters were about, of all that the author has said, this is the reason for it. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1 is the bottom line of Hebrews 1 through 7. We have such a high priest, Yeshua HaMashiach, set on the right hand of Jehovah's majesty, our majestic throne in the heavens. If we relate the throne of majesty in heaven to the tree of Sephirot, we can see that it relates to the Ein Sof, the one who is without bounds and end, and therefore unknowable to our finite minds. There's an old hymn, and the last verse of it goes like this. When we've been there forevermore, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we had first begun. That he is set on the right hand shows that he is the one who works the power of the Almighty in all of his creation, and that he does so through his love for and compassion on his creation. That's the right hand of Jehovah. Yeshua's Melchizedek high priest is better than Aaron's Levitical high priest, because he doesn't need to offer for his own sins, and his life does not end. But that isn't all. The venue in which he serves is better as well, because it is not made by men's hands, but by Jehovah El Shaddai himself. This was the pattern that Moshe used to construct the Mishkan. And as glorious as the Mishkan was, it was but a shadow of the true Kodesh Kadeshim in which Yehovah serves and served. Verse 3 through 5 begins to make the argument that since Yeshua is of a better priesthood in a better venue, he also has to have a better offering than Aharon. And Rav Shaul takes the next two chapters to make that case that this is exactly what Yeshua did. But our reading doesn't go that far. The reading supports the Torah portion, which support is actually seen in verse 5. But verse 4 says that here on earth, while the temple yet stood, Yeshua had no standing to offer sacrifices or offerings of any sort, being of the tribe of Yehuda, not of Levi. He couldn't go into the tabernacle, into the temple, and offer sacrifices because he was of the wrong family, of the wrong tribe. Okay? He wasn't even of Levi, much less of the family of Aaron. Yeshua could not perform offerings in the earthly tabernacle or temple, but as a priest forever, after the order or the same type as Melchizedek, he can in the true tabernacle or in the true temple in heaven. His priesthood's venue is of a higher realm, the realm of Atzilut, on the end of the Ein Sof, the unknowable God, the one who is so far beyond our ability because he has no end in any direction. He has no end in time. He has no end in space. He is everywhere, every time, everything, okay, is within his purview. He is transcendent of his creation, but immanent to it. He works in dichotomies like that all the time. Anyway, that's all I've got on the Brit Hadashah portion for today, and that's the end of my notes for the day. If you have questions or comments, please raise your hand and ask them. Okay. No questions or comments? No questions or comments. It's 12:18 and we've exhausted this thing already? Come on, really? Yeah, that was fast. Sunflower for my bonnet. What did you have to say there? I didn't. Oh, there it is. Amazing Grace is Elohim. You are correct. We can go ahead and just take questions in general. Then we can go ahead and declare that the Midrashic study is over, and Dumrod or whoever it is that's doing the recording can take it and file it, or he can stay and we'll just ask. You got questions or comments about general subjects, we'll be happy to go with that too. Let me remind you all that we're having a gathering for at the time of Sukkot this year here in Northeast Ohio. If anyone is interested in taking part in that with us, we'll be there's the campground site, and all you have to do is email me, mark@fulfillingtorah.net. mark@patron.net. The Fulfilling Torah website is gone. Working on getting that back up. Anyway, the costs are going to be very minimal for the 8 whole days. I don't think it'll cost anyone more than about $250 to $300 for the camping. And so it should be within everybody's reach, if not physically to get here, at least economically, it should be within everybody's reach. A lot of dollars. Well, we're talking about 8 nights of camping, and most of that money is going to the campground itself, and not to us. We'll be adding another $5 or $6 a night to pay for the. For the room that we're going to be in. Okay. So, if there are any general questions that you have, be more than happy to try to field them. Whether or not I actually get the throw all the way to first base is another thing, but I'll try to field the questions anyway. Oh, you did. How vital is it that we acknowledge Jehovah has a son? Is there a penalty for failing to acknowledge this? Since it's only through his son that we are able to access the Father, then yes, there's a great penalty in failing to acknowledge that he exists. And that's just how that is. Many of the people in the Islamic tradition live a moral life, but they're not acknowledging that Yeshua is the Son of Elohim, that he is Elohim in the flesh. I think it's of no value to them whatsoever to be moral. I think that's the reason that the radical Islamists have just given up on morality. Other questions? Mashiach now. You have your hand up. You may go ahead and take it.
Well, good Shabbos. I just wanted to say something that might be worthy of consideration. Surely Hashem has given us understanding, which we should be grateful for. Not everybody has all understanding yet, like we think we do. But remember the parable that Yeshua gave about a man who said, I will do something, and he didn't. And another man said, I won't do it. But he actually did in the end. And Yeshua said, which one was more justified before God? And I take the understanding that not all who say, I believe in the Son, are living their lives as if they do. And not all who don't have the historical knowledge that a son came 2,000 years ago are not living by the words of the son and the principles of the son. So just something for consideration.
Yep. You're right. James chapter 1 and verses 18 through 25 tell us all about that and other places. Paul writes about it. Peter writes about it. John writes about it. If you're not doing the word, if you're just acknowledging that it's true, but you're not doing it in your life, then your faith is really vain. Eves, you have your hand up and you may take the mic.
In regards to this question, I have another question. When it says that every knee shall bow to Yeshua as the Lord and every tongue shall confess God, I perceive that that is a future event that doesn't happen until his coming, until he's here. Because up until that point, we know in Revelation, right up till the very end, there are people not bowing to him or confessing to God. So that has to be after his return. So then the question is, how is it that every knee, because I take that literally, every knee, and I think it goes on to say that every eye, whether it be in heaven, on earth, or below the earth, shall see him coming. So that's why I tend to believe that when Jesus died, he redeemed all mankind from Adam forward, every single one. Now the outcome of what happens to them as to whether or not they have or they don't gets decided at some point further down after he comes. But nonetheless, it still says every eye is going to see him coming and every knee is going to bow to him. So I might be a little bit off here, but I tend to believe that when people get resurrected, they all get resurrected. And then the decision is made as to what happens to them. Some, as Daniel say, have eternal glory and some to everlasting shame. But whether or not that's true or not, it still says that every knee is going to bow to him and every eye is going to see him. And I know that hasn't occurred and does not occur, that every knee is going to bow to him until after he returns. So my, and along these lines, then my question would be, do they have to confess? Let's say somebody who didn't know him. Do they have to bow their knee to him, and if they've already lived and died prior to his coming or after his coming? So it doesn't really, and I didn't have these thoughts until this last year, to bow their knee to him and accept him as Messiah. Does mankind that didn't know him prior have the opportunity to hear the gospel at another point, and I'm talking about the millennial kingdom, and have the opportunity to choose at that time? Or does that mean at that point they're all dead? Oh my goodness. So that would be my question, fulfilling Torah. Does mankind have to bow their knee before, bow their knee after his return? I release your release the mic.
Okay. Sorry about that, guys. This guy came in here and he's gone now. He's been bounced. If you don't mind, Steve, find that guy inciting sedition and ban him. I haven't done that yet. And that started coming up and I missed almost everything that you said, Eves. I'm sorry. Meanwhile, Faith Builder 7, you may take the mic.
Thank you very much. I was wondering if I might be able to get a little bit of help in understanding the Revelation chapter 20, the millennium. Is there any other verses, with the exception of Revelation, that can show me more about where it says in the scriptures the millennium or the 1,000 years? I appreciate any scriptures at all. Thank you very much. Next.
Okay, to find the word millennium, you're not going to find it anywhere. I don't think it's even in Revelation, although it does say 1,000 years. But millennium is actually a Latin word, and you could find it in the Latin Vulgate more than likely. You're not going to find a reference to the 1,000 years, I don't think, anywhere in Tanakh. However, you will find things that have been prophesied that will happen during the reign of the Messiah, and that is revealed to us in Revelation as being 1,000 years. That's really the best I can do for you at this point. If someone else has a more complete answer, I'd be more than happy to let you have the mic and go ahead and expound for us. Servant 60, you may take the mic.
Thank you, Mark. Can anyone hear me? Give me a one. Okay, thank you. Eves, you were talking about the people who had not heard of the God of Abraham, Father Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. Will they also have to bow their knees down? The question it comes to my mind is that my oldest daughter, who had passed away in 2005, was 40 years old. And as at birth, she was what they call mentally challenged. In other words, by the time she was 40, she had the mind of a 3-year-old. And since she had passed away, the thought has come to my mind, too, when you had just mentioned, will she have to bow her knee to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Will God impart his spirit into her so she'll understand that this God that she is bowing down to is the God of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob? This is the question that has arisen in my mind, too. She does not know him. She was not able to understand anything. She was only had the mind of a 3-year-old. So I believe that when all is said and done, at the end, I believe that he will raise her up like all the other children who are mentally challenged and those who are not, who have never heard of God or Yeshua, will be raised to understand. I believe that the spirit of Yah will go into each and every one of these people, that they'll understand, yes, this is, you know, who he is. I could be wrong. I don't know. But that is my take on those who don't understand. I release the mic.
I think that all has to do with what has been come to be known in Christian circles as the age of accountability. And I think that there are some people who just never reach that age. Exactly. Very good. Like children under the age of accountability. It's not actually an age. It's the ability to understand certain things. And I think ...65 years old and never reach that age of mental incapacity or physical incapacity. If they don't reach that particular thing, then they, you know, I think that Yah gives them a lot more grace than he does those of us who are not incapacitated. Anyway, Voice of Reason 1, you may have the mic. Voice of Reason, you may have the mic. Voice of Reason must actually be gone. Faith Builder 7, you may have the mic.
All right, thank you. In the 80s, I went to Messianic Synagogue with Rabbi Jerry Keyes for many years after that. And then I had to move away from Florida to Indianapolis and trying to find a place to where I can get fed and learn more. And unfortunately, many of the places that I've gone to try and to visit, I'm not even getting milk to get fed. Where... since I'm in Indianapolis, where can I go, do you know of any place that where I can learn more? I've been very hungry for 25 years to know more and to know more. And I think it's very difficult. And no disrespect to any of the churches, but when you hear over and over again, many of the same things with different titles, you're just not satisfied. So I do study every day. I study, and I'm just not getting what I really need. And anyway, I just thought I'd ask maybe a website that you could recommend or something like that. All right, thank you.
Okay, well, you could come and visit with us on Shabbat mornings. That's number one, like you are today. There are a number of websites. tryhebrews.org. You missed the R there. How did that happen? Well, anyway, you could try hebrews.org. That's Eddie Chumney's site. It's very good. You could try yashanet.org or com, rather. That's www.yashanet.com. Very good stuff. Those are two that come to mind right off. Those are good websites that you could work at. Before, waytozion.org. Very good. Thank you, Rip. Very good. Waytozion.org has a huge archive of teachings and stuff, including these teachings that we do here on Shabbat mornings, also Eddie Chumney's 5-Minute Updates and his teachings, also Jim Staley's. There are lots and lots of places that ministries that guy archives on that particular website. Very good. Anyway, those are websites that you're going to go and hit. Wisdom in Torah is incredibly good. That is Rico Cortez. He's got some insight like you can't believe. I mean, there are lots of them. Wild Branch Ministries, very good. Also, that's Wild Branch is Brad Scott, I believe. Then there's FFOZ, First Fruits of Zion, very good stuff. Tim Haig, very good stuff. Bill Cloud, very good stuff. I mean, so if you just want to go on the internet and listen to stuff that gets played all day, every day, go to Hebrew Nation Radio, Solace Radio. These are places where people come on, and these are all very, very good places to go. There's lots of excellent teaching out there. You just need to know where to go. And for websites, those are perfect. All of those are really good. MessianicNation.org. I've never been there, but I'll take. Oh, it's a directory. Okay, yes, very good. TruthToYou.org. I'm telling you, that's a wonderful place. That's Jono Vandor. He does interviews with various teachers from all different walks, and very, very good stuff. Anyway, you people keep going. Everybody's giving you links and stuff. Check them out, man. They're all really good. You can, by the way, you can take this, the text here, and you can save it to your and look at all this stuff later on if you'd like. Vic Taylor, you have your hand up. You may have the mic.
Thanks, Mark. Can I be heard, first of all? Somebody give me a one, please. Thank you, Phil. Thank you very much. The question I like to ask Faith Builder, he says he's hungry. And I would ask him, what are you hungry for? Like, are you seeking truth? Are you confused about the doctrines that you've heard and so forth? And my suggestion to you, this is my humble suggestion to you. I don't know if you read the Bible, but you have to get yourself a King James Bible and a Strong's Concordance with the Hebrew and the Greek meaning of terms, and you begin to read that Bible, and you'll come to know the truth if it's the will of the God to open, and you're a sincere truth seeker, you will come into the full knowledge of the truth, because there is many, and that's including the Masonics, have false doctrines. Anyway, I yield the mic.
Thank you, Vic. Yeah, there are lots of places. He says use the King James. That's what I use almost exclusively. It's what I grew up with, you know. It's what I've always read for 35 years now. And, it's just what it's what I'm most comfortable with. I think he meant Messianic as well, rather than Masonic. But, but yeah, he might also have meant Masonic. There's a lot of influence in some of the newer translations, English translations, that it's Masonic as well. But anyway, Faith Builder, you have your hand up. You can go ahead and take the mic again, and then we'll be back to Barak Yahu in a minute.
Right, thank you. And I really, truly appreciate all these websites that you've given me. I will go back and study and learn. I do know the Bible, but I want to know more. A day happened to me in my life to where I stood up and said, with tears in my eyes, I want to know all there is to know about who this God is. And from that time, I've never stopped. And my hunger is for more and more truth and more knowledge. So that's why I had asked. And I really appreciate the people that has posted these websites and your help. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. I hope that it was of good value to you. Like I said, come on back next Shabbat. We'll be happy to have you. Barak Yahu, you can take the mic.
I think I can speak for everybody here in this one statement, and that is that since the Six-Day War of Israel, there has been a revolution of the last days. And the plain example of that is that we're all being that, well, not all of us, forgive me. God has chosen many who have become enlightened and want to learn more. And I believe you're just one more example of this revolution of people wanting to know the real truth and not just suck down the garbage from rabbis and pastors. I put up eSword there, and then eSword is a free downloadable Bible, and the really neat thing is that you can mouse over each of the words, and it'll give you the original word in Greek or Hebrew and the definitions for it, so you can check the accuracy of the King James. So, your mic.
Okay. eSword is a wonderful tool, by the way. If you haven't got that, it's the first thing under my. You know, I've got in my bookmarks. I've got a particular thing for biblical stuff, you know, and that's the first thing on there because eSword is a great tool for study. Okay. Monty Judah's Lion Lamb, yeah, good stuff. Okay, well, are other questions or comments? They didn't open the room today for whatever reason, Lech Lecha. I don't know why. It looks like they didn't open the room at all. Vic, you may take the mic.
Thank you, Mark. Another question I like to ask Faith is, are you keeping the Sabbath day? And are you keeping the annual feast days, which are also Sabbath days? If you're doing that, you're almost got your foot in the whole truth. But there's one subtle and deceptive teaching that comes from the Roman Church that most of the churches and organizations on Peltok and in the world teach. And that's the one you've got to find the truth about. And that's how the Creator is separating those who know, truly know Him and know His Son. But if you're keeping the Sabbath and the feast days in the Torah, you're on the right track. And I yield the mic.
Watch out, Vic. You don't want to tell too much truth. You might scare everybody away. Are there other questions or comments? Anybody at all? Anybody at all? Well, should go ahead and take the mic then, Faith Builder, if you're... Go ahead, take the mic.
Yes, in Ocala I have heard of Samuel, and there's another excellent Samuel Bakioki, and I know several different, but the Sabbath and the Holy Days, I started them back in the 80s. So yes, the answer to that is yes, I do. I've kept the feast days, the Holy Days, for many, many years. So I don't know if that... I don't know what else to say except I'm really glad to find this room, and I will be here as much as possible to listen and to keep my mouth shut and to learn. Okay, thank you.
Don't just come to keep your mouth shut. If you have something that's salient to add, please do. Okay, we look. I am of the opinion that each word of Scripture, really, but each verse of Scripture in particular, is like a diamond, well cut and many faceted, suspended above a light source, and the light shines up through the bottom of the thing, and then it gets diffused all around. Through the different facets, and people are sitting around this thing and they're seeing each scripture just a little bit differently. Okay? And I think that it's important for us to all contribute what it is that we're seeing so that we can all understand everything that scripture has to say. Okay? So, I really do not mind rabbit trails. Okay? If that's going to get us to the truth of what's in the scripture. Berech Yahu, you may take the mic.
Faith Builder, I don't know how brave you are to talk to people that you meet every day, but if you're courageous, you'll be surprised on how many people that are just ready to learn the truth. I mean, they know that they've been told lies, and they really want to learn the truth, and they just don't know where to turn, and they just don't know that the truth exists. And I bump into people at least every other day that are ready to learn the truth and just want to get some kind of an inkling on what direction to proceed in. So, you know, there are tremendous opportunities for fellowship if you're willing to just confront people and use some discernment on where they are.
Okay, good stuff. Good stuff. We're nearing the end of our time. It's 1:00. Are there any other questions or comments? Yes. Torah Talk 119. We have to live the Torah for all those who are looking. That's exactly right. And you have to assume that everybody's looking. Somebody asked me the other day, what are you wearing those funny strings on your belt loops for? And the answer to that question is, well, number one, God commanded me to. Number two, He gave me the reason for it was so that it would help me to remember to keep the commandments. And number three, so the people like you will ask me what they're there for, so that I can give a reason for the hope that lies within me. So, yeah, we need to live what we teach, what we believe. Okay? To the best of our ability. When people see that you're not two-faced about it, then they're going to want to know what about that hope that lies within you. I mean, that's 1 Peter chapter 2, I think. The hope that lies within you? I think so. It's one of those Peter books anyway. Other questions or comments? I'm sorry, I really and truly did have a tree whack me on the head, and I know what's there, I just don't know exactly the address sometimes. Yeah, exactly. Why do you wear your wedding ring? Well, my wedding ring was stolen long, long ago, so I don't have one. But I would still be wearing it had it not been stolen from me. Should a woman wear tzitzit? She's not told not to. There's no prohibition of it. So, you know, here's the question. Is the woman that's wearing the tzitzit in submission to her husband? If she's not, she ought not wear the tzitzit because she's not fulfilling Torah. Which, by the way, is why we call our room Fulfilling Torah. That's why my ministry is called Fulfilling Torah Ministries. Okay? Because that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be fulfilling it as best we can. And by the way, none of us are going to be able to do that all the time. You know, we're going to screw up because we're human. We still have the flesh yelling at us all the time. I don't think that it's just men that are commanded to wear them. Hang on a minute. Let me look that up. Numbers chapter 15. Take a second for me to get there. Numbers chapter 15. And back down to verse 132. Let's see. And said unto Moses, man shall be surely put to death. Okay. Speak unto the children of Israel. This is in verse 37. Numbers 15:37. Speak unto the children of Israel and bid them that they make them fringes on the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of Jehovah to do them. And that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after that which you used to go a-whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments and be holy unto your Elohim. I am Jehovah your Elohim, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your Elohim. I am Jehovah your Elohim. Doesn't say anything about men. It says children of Israel. B'nai Israel. That means men and women, I think. There's no prohibition against women wearing it. Why is it that only men are supposed to wear them? I think we have a rabbinic tradition there. So, we have a commandment that we're supposed to wear them. So, let's wear them. And you know what? You can go to Joanne Fabrics or somebody like that, and you can buy yourself four different colors of DMC threads, or even just two different colors of DMC threads. They're embroidery threads. They last for almost ever. I buy four colors myself. I buy a blue one because I'm commanded to wear blue. Then I buy a brown, almost dirt brown, beige, almost just a little bit off white, and green. And I have myself camis to go with whatever I happen to be wearing, and a ribbon of blue in there. It's the ribbon of blue is all that I'm worried about. All the rest of it, you can put whatever you want in there, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, so I think that we should all be wearing tzitzit. There is no command that says that a woman is not allowed to wear them. And so the answer to the question is yes, wear them. You know? Baruch Yahu, you may have the mic.
B'nai, in Hebrew, is a male form of the word. And similarly to English, in Hebrew they often use the male form of the word for everybody. Even though, yes, in the text it is a male gender word. But you find that in English too, in the same way. And I agree, it's just rabbinical nonsense to put women under more submission than our God requires. But if you go with, you know, the off-white or white or off-white with blue, and wear them out in public, you can rouse a whole lot of wonderful discussions with people that want to criticize you for it, and then you get to stand up for what you know is the truth.
Exactly. You get to give a reason for the hope that lies within you. And yeah, the in Hebrew, as well as in Hebrew anyway, if you have a crowd of people, you could have 25,000 people, and they're all female except one. Okay? That crowd is referred to as in the masculine. You have one male among 25,000 females, and you're talking to that whole group. You're talking to B'nai Yisrael. That is the male thing. It's done because the man is there. And the woman comes from man. That's what I think the reason for that is. But anyway, I'm going to give the mic to Vic Taylor.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I was just wondering, you know, there's lots of discussion. I remember being in a room with discussing the tzitzit, however you say it. It's my feeling that you are not to have it hanging out where others can see it, although it's a good point you pointed out that it certainly will arouse a discussion, and it may be a good thing, but it's my understanding you're to wear it underneath your clothing so that when you put it on in the morning, you're to see it and you're to remember the commandments and to carry them out to the day that you wake up and through the through the night. You know what I mean? They're for your own a reminder that you're to keep the commandments as you wake up and put on your clothing to go out in the world and keep God's commandments. But as you said, it may, displaying a religious symbol on the outside, it could create some conversation and discussion, and also bring contempt and persecution. And I don't think that's what the Messiah or the Creator wanted or is intended to bring a persecution upon you. It's for your own personal benefit that you walk in His ways and let the other people, whatever, they'll find out the truth, God willing, at some point in their life, if they're truly seeking it. And I yield the mic.
Thanks, Vic. See? We can disagree. And it's okay. Ain't it cool? See, I think that the rabbis will teach you that it's supposed to be seen. And I don't have a real problem with, I don't have a problem either way. You know, if you want to wear them under your clothes, that's fine. If you want to wear them out where people can see them, that's fine. Whatever you want to do. But I personally think that it's better if we do that on the outside and hope that people will ask what they're there for. I mean, you know, I'm not going to go and accost people with my belief. I'm not going to do that. I won't take somebody's head off because they don't believe the same way I do, like some radical people in another religion will do. But I don't see a problem with engendering questions by things that I do. Okay? Anyway, it's whatever. In that particular case, it's a whatever. Whatever you decide. Whatever the Father is leading you to do. So, other questions or comments? How do you celebrate Rosh Hashanah? Rosh Hashanah. Actually, I don't celebrate, if I'm going to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, it's going to be on the first day of the first month, which is the beginning of the year. Now, Yom Teruah, that we're going to celebrate in a couple of weeks, and we're going to get together and have a minor moed, I guess, because that's, you know, it's a moed. So we're going to get together and actually going to have a teaching on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah. Other questions, maybe? Vic has his hand up. Let him take the mic.
Thanks, Mark. I was just saying, wearing a tzitzit, is that a salvational issue? I never thought of it as a salvational issue if you don't wear them. Because if someone doesn't wear them yet is keeping the commandments, there's a possibility someone could wear them and not be keeping the commandments, like hypocrites. And that's what the Messiah pointed out. He says they wear these philosophies, whatever, hangings on their robes, whatever, to show that they were righteous, and they were whitewashed tombs. They were hypocrites. So that's another fear of wearing or presenting to the world as if you were a holy and a virtuous person, and you're inside, you're full of corruption and sin. Anyway, I yield the mic.
Yeah, it's a point well taken. Are you wearing them because you want people to think that you're holy? Most people don't even know what they are. As far as the tzitziot go, the phylacteries. Very few people even know what those are. They're gonna look at you real funny. What are those boxes? What's that box you got on the middle of your forehead there, boy? but basically, I'm commanded to wear them. They're there to help me to remember the commandments. And I wear them on the outside where people can see them so that they'll ask me what they're about. So they'll open the discussion, not me. That's just the way that I do that. And the phylacteries, I don't know, having the things wrapped around your arm and all that, and the thing on your forehead, I don't think that in particular has anything to do with having the word of Yehovah on your mind and on your hand, on your heart, and you doing it. It's an outward show of it. And sometimes that can get very religious. You are correct. And unfortunately, maybe the tzitzit can do the same thing. Get very religious. If it's religious, it's not good. I do not believe that wearing them or not wearing them where they can be seen is a salvational issue. I believe that it is an obedience issue, though. And that's okay. Other questions or comments? Vic Taylor, you may take the mic.
I didn't realize the phylacteries, however you pronounce it, I didn't realize it was that box on your head or the wrappings around your arm. I thought it was something the Messiah was referring to with respect to the robes. They hung certain things on the robes. I thought that's what... to show that they were a priest or they were virtuous or holy. And I'm just going to look up the word now to find out what the Greek meaning of that term is. Anyway, Mark, thank you.
Okay, yeah, the phylacteries are little boxes, and that little box has scripture in it. I think it might have the Shema in it, like a mezuzah. I'm not sure what's all in there, because I've never worn one. It's an outward sign of what's supposed to be inside. And if that's what it is, then there isn't any problem with it. Okay? But if it's just a religious show, then it's just a religious show. Okay, are there other questions or comments? Be happy to give up the mic. Ah, okay, so the specific commandment for keeping the law on your mind and keeping the law on your hands or in your hands is what's actually in those particular boxes. I see. Ancient factories. Barak Yahoo, you just put your hand up. Take the mic.
Yeah, those boxes are another part of the bondage of the Pharisaical system. Those verses are supposed to be is that God is supposed to be, God and His commandments are supposed to be the ornaments before our eyes, not between our eyes. In Hebrew, that word can be taken as before or in front of or between. And Torah is supposed to be the ornaments before our eyes. And that in Hebrew, the hand and the forearm is one. And so by the idea is that everything that we do should reflect Torah, not that we should be in put our arms in bondage with leather straps.
Okay, as I said before, the truly righteous ones, that's the outward expression of the inward reality. Okay, they're keeping the word of Elohim on their minds, and they're working the word of Elohim and through their lives. And so, the phylacteries for them, specifically an outward expression of what's actually happening inside. Got no problem with that, none whatsoever. It's if they're putting those things on just for the outward show. Just to show people how holy they are, then there's a problem. That's where the problem is. Voice of Reason, you have your hand up. You may take the mic.
Yep. Well, I'm guessing this is a, is this like a Jewish room? Like, Jewish, or is it like a Messianic, or, you know, all above and more, okay, cool, you know, to keep all 613 of those laws is not easy, you know what, so, do you guys believe that I'm not even sure if you guys even believe in hell. But, so, being as you guys are saying, it's impossible to keep all those laws. You guys know it's impossible to die without sin. Right? Because you'll have some sin when you die. And, you know, I mean, are you going to go to hell if you have sin? Because, and I'm not even a Christian. I guess I've been around Christians so long that I have this Christian thinking, but how are you guys going to make it? I mean, you don't have Jesus or some other person to just wipe it all away like the Christians do. Christians just say, you know, they believe in Jesus. That takes care of all their sin. Ten Commandments. Well, you know, the Ten Commandments are, I guess, let me see, what are they again? I used to know these by heart. Keep the Sabbath, right? Do not kill, do not steal, do not covet. No, I'm not a Muslim. Why do people assume that it's like almost like the only three religions in the world are Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. I mean, I'm not any of those three. But, okay. Well, I don't think I'm attacking. I just asked a question. I mean, you know, you can't keep the law, so how do you make it into heaven? Unless, or are you saying God doesn't mind if you have some sin? And then I guess that begs the question, how much sin will God accept? Anyway, next in the mic.
Hey, thanks. I found the meaning of it, and Mark, you're right. According to Strong's, it says guardian case for wearing slips of scripture, and it comes from the root word, which says to guard and keep, observe, and save. So I thank you. I had the impression I should look at the scripture. I thought it was something at the end of their robes that denoted that they were priests or holy men or men of God. Anyway, thank you, Mark.
Servant 60, the least of the commandments is supposedly the one that says that if you find a bird's nest that the mother has abandoned, that how you deal with that. And I can't remember exactly where that is or exactly what it says, but the least of the commandments has to deal with you taking care of a sparrow or something like that. So that's the best I can do on that. Mark, another question keeps digging. What's the question? If you'd like to take the mic, please come ahead. If not, go ahead and put it in text. Okay. Are there other questions or comments? Do you think it's right for believers to call an unbeliever brother? I don't know. I have three unbelieving brothers. They're all my brothers. I don't know. I don't know. You know, it's come to be very often just a colloquialism, talking about another guy. You know, hear what I'm saying, brother? You know. So I don't know if it's right or wrong. I don't think that's a case one way or another. Yeah, or bro. Hey, bro, how you doing? Yeah. Don't tase me, bro. There you go, voice of reason. That's cool. Absolutely right. I don't know. I think we're getting exactly... Torah talk. I think we're getting down to semantics. Just because you're somebody is not a believer, does that mean you can't call him brother? Is there a command that says don't call anyone brother who is not a believer? I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. So whether it's right or wrong is, you know, now you're talking about a matter of morality, not a matter of whether it's righteous or unrighteous, you know. Other questions or comments? Kimmelburgers, what are those? Are those like White Castles? Those things that are like one bite hamburgers? Camel with a Yiddish accent, okay. Okay. Yeah, Torah, I think you got a you got a point there. I mean, we have a lot of people that are, you know, I referred earlier today to that tree of Sephiroth, okay, the picture of the Almighty in the way that he's, the way that he reveals himself to us. And, you know, in that thing you have, in that one that I, that we had a link to, in Zion, that's the one right there, Zion.org, you see you see the representation of a man in the middle of the thing, okay, and he's reaching out with his right hand and his left hand, and his right hand reaches over to the Yehovah's side, and the left hand reaches over to Elohim's side, okay, and he's the mixture of the two. And by the way, his hands are on the Chesed and the Gevurah, okay, the Chesed of Yehovah, the goodness, the loving kindness, the mercy of God, and the left hand goes over to the Gevurah, the power, the justice, the righteousness of God. And he's the perfect embodiment of the two. And I believe that that man represents Messiah. Okay? And his right hand is the right hand. So, we need to stay away from, we're told in other places that we are not to go to the right hand or to the left. Okay? That we're supposed to stay on the straight path through, right through the body of Messiah. From Malchut, the kingdom, to the Ein Sof, the unknowable God. Okay? And it's a perfectly straight line, and everything's connected. So if we go too far to the right hand, then we get too far into the love and the mercy and forget about the righteousness and the judgment of God. But if we get too far to the, and therefore we get to places that you might call universalism, okay, where everybody gets to go to you know, to be in the new heaven and new earth. And then we get to the other side on the left. And if we get too far to the left, then we get to where we're judging everybody. And we're actually being quite self-righteous. And what we need to do is strike the balance that Messiah struck. Okay? There are those who are going to be judged. And they're not going to be in the kingdom. And there are those who we might think ought to be judged who are going to receive the mercy and the grace of Yehovah. So we need to be very careful about who we exclude. Okay? I would really rather lean to the right, but I want to walk the straight and narrow path. Okay? And that is right through Messiah. So Let's be careful about are we going to exclude people because they don't believe exactly the same way that we do on a particular issue? I think it would be a very unwise thing to do. This room opens at 10. The room opens for study at 10:30. It actually opens usually in the neighborhood of 8 o'clock, and on Shabbat mornings. And Rip Van opens the room and he plays music for two and a half hours before we actually start teaching. We start teaching at 10:30, or roughly, as close to 10:30 as we can. Turn off the vehicle and park. TT119. Oh, okay. Eve's Garden, you may take the mic.
So that was just my silly humor. But in regards to judging others, we can talk about it, but think about this. This is pretty awesome responsibility. And awesome, I don't mean like great fun, awesome, kind of cool. I mean like fearsome, maybe, because if we're going to be chosen to be the bride that rules and reigns, you know what kind of responsibility that the bride's going to have to teach the nations that are still alive on the earth over this 1,000-year period, who's going to populate the earth to be so plenteous that it's probably beyond comprehension how many people there's going to be at the end of the time, to teach them, people who are going to know, like, nothing, maybe nothing about the Torah, and may not believe any of it. And, you know, it says that they have to come up for the feast. And if they don't come up for the feast, the rain is withheld. And if they don't come up for a second time, they get some god-awful plague that causes their flesh to melt off their bodies, their eye sockets to be sunken in, and their tongues to cleave to their mouth. And so this teacher that's going to be the bride and Messiah has to love them so much and teach them, at the same time use this righteous judgment. It's just, I mean, it's a fearful, God-fearful amount of responsibility. And so when we talk about, it's not awesome, probably awful is probably the amount of responsibility, because you don't want to judge quickly, you don't want to judge harshly, and we're going to, praise God, we'll have the spirit of Messiah to be able to judge correctly. So look at the tolerance he had. At the same time, I don't know, just when you think about how great the responsibility is going to be, it just is God-fearing, in my opinion. And so we should be learning and that now, I think, or at least be thinking like that. At least I do on occasion. I don't necessarily, I think that a little bit I think about it, but the truth is, it's a matter of life and death. It's like it's a serious matter, and in that time, it's going to be even more serious. When we start to see it, I think it's going to just be, it's enough to humble a person to almost not want to do it in some regard. But the truth is, when you think about people who will come to righteousness as a result of it, though, because it will be done with the balance of Messiah's judgment and righteous mercy, that it will save and bring many multitudes of people to God. So that is probably the reward in doing it. But there will be people that won't accept, and that's the part that's sort of frightening almost. But anyway, that's what I think about when I hear this discussion, how inept I am or even could possibly be to judge like that right now. And to think, well, if I even want to run the race to be in the running to be one of those chosen, then I should, with all humility, try to use godly discernment in what I'm judging right now. You know, I do judge, and so I do it wrongly, I know that, but I still think about it sometimes, about the amount of responsibility it's going to be in the future. But anyway, that's just my thought. Wanted to share that. I released the mic.
Thank you, Eves. You're right. I personally don't want to judge people. I'd rather stay away from it. There are times when you have to, in order to be righteous, though. And that's, you know, you make those judgments for yourself. And you don't broadcast them, okay? If you can possibly help it, you don't broadcast them. So there's trouble in the body every time something like that happens. Always trouble in the body when something like that happens. Anyway, other questions or comments? Akushnet Bill, by the way, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. Feeling well? Other questions or comments? Anybody got a... Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that, Bill. Yeah. That's an understatement, Vic. We are winding down here, I think. It's about time that we turn this thing back over to Rip and let him play a few songs. If Eddie's 5 minute is posted somewhere, if we can get it going. If not, oh wait, no, take it back. Sorry. No, Eddie has rescinded his permission to play the 5 minute update. I'm sorry, I didn't tell anybody either until just now. But he rescinded his permission to play his 5 minute update. And so, yeah. And I'm not going to get into that. Yes, he did. I'm not going to say why. Okay. That's between me and him. So, we'll, you know, Rip, it's, I'm going to turn this over to you and let you, yeah, so am I, Eves. I'll let you, take this thing back and, I'll just say to you all, Shavua Tov. Thanks for coming and sharing with us. Those of you that did, Berech Yahu and everybody else, Vic and Eves, and we had Voice of Reason in there for a little bit, and a couple other guys, Faith Builder 7. We really appreciate you being here. Please come again. We'll see you next week. You know, Yehovah willing and the creek don't rise. Y'all have a good one. And by the way, don't thank me. It's my pleasure. I really appreciate doing this. I appreciate being able to do this. And so we'll see you next week. And Vic, it's all yours.